Hello, my name is Eric Francis, and for Pacifica Radio, welcome to The Miracle Hour, a program about A Course in Miracles. A Course in Miracles is a book that was published in the year 1976. Since that time, it has been what I would call significantly influential in New Age thinking and to some extent in all forms of modern or contemporary spiritual thinking. Not everyone knows about the existence of this book, but its message and its ideas have had a way of permeating the landscape of new spiritual thought. And I've been working with A Course in Miracles on and off since 1986. It was in March of that year that I obtained my first copy, and soon after began working with it in the form of doing the lessons, commencing the 365 daily lessons that are part of the Course in Miracles workbook. And on and off through my writing career, I've made a number of comments about it over time, but I have not said very much. I have not said very much intentionally, partly because I was not that interested in raising the questions and the controversies that, in my mind at least, surround working with the material. And it's my intention in this series to do precisely that, to bring my own questions, my own thoughts, and my own ideas to the forefront, and not necessarily to be an advocate for The Course in Miracles, but to at least open up a discussion that I think is, at least in my mind, going to be a little bit more balanced than some of the discussions that are out there where there's not really that many questions asked. A couple of points. One is that The Course in Miracles actually is a course in how to perform miracles. This is not any kind of metaphoric concept of what a miracle is. Miracles are defined a couple of different ways, one of which in the course, one of which is an expression of love. This is from the beginning, where I'll read a few of these in a moment, the principles of miracles. And there are other elaborations on the idea where you understand or explained anyway that the that space and time are entirely flexible, and the only thing that would prevent us from believing that a miracle is possible is believing in fixed ideas about space and time. Second thing is I have personally experienced miracles, and therefore I actually know that they are possible, and by that I mean miracles of healing, and then also what I would call highly improbable things happening. Clearly, they are not impossible because they happen, but they were improbable in that I would have said that that was probably unlikely to happen before they happened, though I'm not the kind of person who, that I know of anyway, or admit to, espouse limited beliefs where I will openly say something is impossible. I've pretty much always had the idea that anything is possible, and I have actually experienced a few things that would be considered a real stretch. And one of the teachings in A Course in Miracles is not to use these events as spectacles to induce belief. And so I have remained pretty quiet about them, and I have just lived as best I can in relationship to those experiences, and I've actually forgotten many of them because they do tend to, once their use is done, they tend to disappear and can kind of fade away. Once they've served the purpose of reconciliation or healing or reversing the negative consequences of something, there really is no need for them anymore. There's also a comment in The Course in Miracles, which is properly A Course in Miracles, but it's a little bit cumbersome to keep saying A. It's not as nice as a word of the, as the, perhaps. Well, anyway. is that, again, I have not seen this commented on by anyone who comments on A Course in Miracles. However, somewhere in there, it says that The Course in Miracles is not this book that you're reading. Course in Miracles is the course of your life, wherein you will experience miracles that teach you gradually to have faith and to allow your faith to be the thing that is what you refer to first, rather than depending on something that is, about oneself, that's personal, that to open up faith in something that is more powerful and larger than what we think of as our individual self, right? So far, so good. We're talking about some fairly basic spiritual principles here that once you are familiar with ideas in the Course in Miracles, and if you're also familiar with ideas from mystical Christianity or from some of the more spiritual elements of Hinduism, they start to sound like classical or time-honored spiritual teachings, which is exactly what they are. And in the beginning, the first thing you read in A Course in Miracles is, on the first page, "This is A Course in Miracles. It is a required course. Only the time you take it is optional." So it's implying that, and later it says there's many forms of this course. This is just one form, the form that is appropriate for this particular moment. And it's fair to say that the times we're living in would certainly benefit from miracles. There are a lot of, again, using course terminology, impossible situations that we see in the world, that we witness in the world, and that we are confronted with in our own lives on a more or less constant basis. And most of those involve schisms between people, lack of trust, fallings out, disagreements, outright feuds or wars or battles. And I would say that it is likely that on the first order of priorities of A Course in Miracles is the healing of relationships. Much of the course is dedicated to relationship concepts and to explaining how it is that people relate to one another when they are coming from fear-based realities, and then carefully unraveling the psychology of how you would reverse that, how to think about what's going on, how to understand the phenomenon of the negativity and of the struggle and the lack of contact, the lack of love or the concealment of love, and how to turn that around where it's possible for one mind to reach to another mind and extend the light of healing from one mind to another. So this is a very basic concept, and it is taught in the form of ideas and then encouraged in the form of practice throughout the course's lessons and its textbook and its manual for teachers. That's the basic structure. It is in three volumes. One is a textbook of about 650 pages, that has lots of different ideas in it. And by the way, this is all available online for free. Second volume of the book is the workbook, and this is a lesson a day for 365 days. The lessons tend to be pretty short, so the workbook is probably, 500-page book, but the pages are pretty empty because they're just kind of meditations, and some are longer thoughts that are broken down and explained, where there's a longer phase of reading in the morning. And the lessons are generally done in the form of very brief meditations. The course is not designed as a training in meditation for its own sake, but rather learning how to make contact with your inner source. The third volume is called The Manual for Teachers, and this is pretty much a Q&A format that answers some very basic questions. At the end of that is a clarification of terms. And then there are a couple of other volumes that are very short, that are more like a pamphlet length, that have that came following the dictation of materials from the course. And most people don't officially consider that part of it, but there's a couple of varying definitions. Okay, so far, so good, right? It sounds like it's something perhaps practical. We're talking about a work that provides kind of guidance into the entry of a serious spiritual path. And the purpose of the spiritual path is not to be a better person. The purpose is not to learn things in theory or to sound smart. The purpose of this process is to master healing, to learn how to be a healer so that you can function under any circumstances in a truly challenged and troubled world as a healer, or what the Course calls a miracle worker. So this all sounds pretty good, right? It sounds like it's useful and like it's humane. There are no instructions in the materials anywhere about forming groups, writing books, or having churches or congregations. That has happened plenty. There are people such as Marianne Williamson who've built their entire career on A Course in Miracles. Others such as Hugh Prather, the author of a book called Notes to Myself, a wonderful poetic collection of his notebook jottings that came out in the 70s probably, later transformed himself into A Course in Miracles teacher. He got familiar with the materials and then began writing about them and teaching about them. Gerald Jampolsky, who was involved with the original channeling and production process, not in the very early team, but kind of in the second group that came through. He too has made, a career out of teaching the Course. And some of these teachings are effective, but they're basically commentaries. And what the Course is a direct, it's a direct teaching of how to access further knowledge directly. So the idea of A Course in Miracles is to go beyond the ideas in A Course in Miracles and to be able to tap into your own innate inner wisdom and basically get results. And it is organized in, you know, the form of a text, which is theoretical, and the workbook, which is basically mind training. It's a form of cultivating discipline and learning these 365 basic ideas, and then the manual for teachers handles directly some of the questions that people have about what it means to, proceed with one's life, in essence, as a minister, and what some of the underlying ideas of that ministry are. So this brings in a new idea that practitioners of the Course and those who embrace it are basically functioning as non-ordained ministers. And by minister, I don't mean preacher, though depending on where someone's at with A Course in Miracles, they can be preachy. I haven't really met anyone for a long time who was. But minister, as in someone who ministers to the people, ministers to their community or their workplace, and again, not in the form of proselytizing. This is the idea of proselytizing, I would say, is as far from the intent of A Course in Miracles as anything is. The idea is to minister in the form of being one who is a loving presence in the community and can assist people in whatever it is that the person becomes aware is needed. So that's the basic idea. Now, we could look at this theologically and say, okay, well, this sounds like has some properties of Protestantism where you don't need a priest or the Pope. You contain the source of healing within you. And when I encountered A Course in Miracles at age 22, a couple of days after my 22nd birthday in 1986, I was already Quaker. I was already a member of the Religious Society of Friends. I remain so. And that is something I chose to do when I was 14 years old. And the basic tenets of Quakerism are, first of all, nonviolence. Quakers don't go to war. and we advocate for those who don't want to go to war. So if there's ever a draft and you don't want to go or you don't want your kid to go, the person to talk to first and foremost are the Quakers, though the Universalist, Unitarian Universalists are also pretty committed and good at this as well. Second concept of Quakerism, and this I recognized from the materials in the Course in Miracles, is the inner light. So in Quaker theology and practice, God is acknowledged as an inner being, something in the mind. And in Christian theology, that's usually called the Holy Spirit, and that's how it's referred to in A Course in Miracles. And so what A Course in Miracles presents is a kind of a structure of the mind where basically there are two options for what to tune into. One is the ego, a term that was made popular by Sigmund Freud, the ego being a kind of a personality matrix within the mind, closely associated with the body. And the other option to tune into is the Holy Spirit, or what the Quakers call the inner light. And this is a source within every person that is connected to the same thing within every other person. And so the way that healing reaches from one person to another is through this inner network, this inner spiritual medium that connects all beings, called the Holy Spirit. So the Holy Spirit is, you might say, of the one many. It's e unum pluribus, I guess. It is God, however that manifests for you, manifesting as something within each person. Some people are aware of it. Some people are not aware of it. Some use it actively. Some resist it actively. But the basic format of the training of A Course in Miracles is to help you differentiate between what it calls the ego's voice and the voice of the Holy Spirit so that you can tune in and listen for yourself and therefore not need someone to explain things to you, not need someone to tell you. And the one of the main disciplines in the training is to teach you to basically listen to this inner guidance all the time and follow it all the time in all the decisions that you make, and to allow that process of listening and decision making to guide you to a better place, a place of healing, and also a life of being functional in a world that is in a lot of pain as a practicing healer. Everyone has a story of when and how A Course in Miracles come into their life, or at least people who have worked with the materials and who have gone on this journey. And the story of my connecting with it is that it came into my life when I was in a pretty vulnerable moment. I guess in March of 1986, when the books arrived at my house in Buffalo, I wasn't quite aware fully of the vulnerability that I was in, but as the next few months progressed, it became kind of obvious what was going on. There was, first of all, I was in my completing my fifth year at the State University of New York at Buffalo. So I was about to graduate. I chose to graduate in 5 years rather than four, which was, controversial to my father, who believed that a four-year degree should be in 4 years. But I took my fifth year, paid for by my Aunt Josie, and by a student loan that also my dad paid off. So to his credit, he contributed to half of something he objected to strenuously. And so I was facing a big transition in my life, and I was also in the midst of a political campaign, which is something that I did a lot more of when I was younger. It was one of my kind of modes of participation in society, which was to write and manage and organize and finance political campaigns on the student level. And also, I was beginning to do this on the professional level in Buffalo city politics. And one of the things that went wrong in the spring of 1986 was that that political campaign ran into some problems because of violations of campaign spending rules, campaign finance rules, that were only an issue because I managed to, you know, co-write and co-design a winning campaign. And so the fact that we won and won by so many votes made the whole thing controversial. And so began a kind of a 3-month massive controversy that marked the ending of my time as someone who'd otherwise had a highly respected career as a student leader at SUNY Buffalo. The mere fact of being on the brink of leaving a community that I had pretty much personally thought of and woven together, taking personal credit and not necessarily the action of spirit working, clearly there was some collaboration of my will and what seemed like something greater working in the community. Leaving that had me really on edge. I was pretty freaked out about the idea of going out into what at the time seemed like a challenging and hostile world without the friends that I had made and the colleagues I had made. The other thing that happened was I had, at some point in that spring, perhaps around May of that year, a bad trip on a drug called ecstasy, or MDMA. This was the good stuff. It was Molly. It was first coming out in the mid-1980s, or at least becoming widely available, and it was probably much better grade. It was pure molecule, and I overdid it a little bit, and let's say one night went down a really dark road. Typically, the beauty of Molly is that you kind of embark on a trip of unconditional love, and it, for that reason, makes a very good therapy drug, because people who would otherwise have total enmity toward one another and hostility and disagreement and the lack of willingness to even speak to one another might actually be fully forgiving in one another's presence and take that away as a kind of a missing experience. And that is something I experienced plenty of, and it was fabulous, and I loved it. Only what happened on this particular night was the opposite happened. I kind of tapped into a well of shadow and darkness and fear and guilt, and fortunately had a pretty high-minded lover at the time named Ginger. And all I remember is her saying this one prayer about cloaking me in a veil of white light with all the love, power, and beauty of God over and over and over and over again. That's pretty much all I remember from it, except for the feeling of kind of like going down this tunnel. And when I woke up the next morning, something was different. I had changed. Something had seemed to have kind of snapped or cracked open in my mind, and I was clearly injured and knew that I needed something. And so into that space of vulnerability and injury, I began doing A Course in Miracles. And so this whole scenario unfolded of the political campaign that got really weird, and thankfully we had absolutely excellent legal representation in the form of a young third-year law student named David Hoffman. We were very well connected. What we had done wrong was not all that wrong. It was fairly typical of what happened. Because I had run so many campaigns, I knew how all the campaigns were run. And so that eventually worked itself out. And I knew that I was going to be kind of leaving the nest, leaving my community. And added to that was the kind of weird sensation of being in this what seemed like compromised or broken or knocked down state as a result of this one particular bad trip, but that I understood was tapping into something that was already there. It was not like this was induced by drugs so much as drugs do provide a kind of a magnification of something that's always present. There was one other factor at this time, which was that in April, the Chernobyl incident happened. That was a massive nuclear meltdown in the Ukraine. And this also sent me into some shock. I was well aware of the nuclear issue because my dad was a public relations man in the nuclear industry. And so I knew the truth of nuclear power. I knew the lies of nuclear power. And now there was this massive nightmare unfolding in the Ukraine, which took months to partly bring under control and was never fully brought under control. They're still doing things 30 years later to try to contain the radiation. And that was a very serious problem. And I experienced that both emotionally and energetically. It was as if the breach of control over that device somehow soaked the earth both in radiation and in fear. And I kind of got the feeling of that and to some extent really experienced it personally and was in a tremendous grief. I also knew at that time that I would become an environmental journalist, though I had no idea what that meant, had no idea how to get there. So the point I'm making is that there was trouble at the time that the Course in Miracles came into my life, and you might say that I received it as welcome news. And I did so with a completely open heart, willing to at least experiment with the ideas. I'm not the type of person who can pretend to believe things that I don't believe, but one of the better things about A Course in Miracles is it doesn't say you have to believe anything, you merely need to consider the ideas. Okay, now I commenced this at the end of getting a university degree in English, and at the end of having been editor-in-chief of a few different publications and understanding something about investigative reporting. I had in fact begun my environmental investigative reporting career several years earlier, but I didn't quite think of it that way. And so I was trained in how to read. It wasn't like I started reading this with no ability to scrutinize the material, but I didn't really use my critical reading capacity to scrutinize as much as I did to comprehend what was being said, what the ideas being presented were. And I think that I was definitely on the appropriate reading level to have an idea what was going on, and I had a sufficient spiritual background to recognize some of the concepts that were coming, to recognize there was something a bit of a universal or, let's say, global scale teaching being presented to me. And I began in earnest and started the lesson several times, and then over that summer heard that there was a community in Piscataway, New Jersey, called Miracle Manor, kind of a fun name for a place that was a former convent on 16 acres of land in a beautiful, very quiet spot in central New Jersey, right along the Raritan River. So it was really, you know, considering how crazy central New Jersey can be, this was quite a beautiful and, secluded spot. And Miracle Manor was beginning its second year. The whole place had been manifested at a meeting about a year and a half earlier in New York City, where a group of Course in Miracles students got together and they said, okay, what do we need in a place to have a Course in Miracles community? And so someone raised their hand and they said there should be water, and someone raised their hand and said there should be enough dormitory space, and someone said, well, there should be a big kitchen, and then someone said, oh, I think there should be a large multi-purpose room. And someone said, well, it really would help if it was, you know, accessible to New York City. And all these ideas were written onto a blackboard. And then at the end of the conversation, someone raised their hand and said, I know just such a place. And that place turned out to be this convent in Piscataway. And the landlord, this guy named Mario, rented it to Alan Cohen, the author of The Dragon Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and Betty Sprague, and they ran this kind of residential Course in Miracles program for 1 year. Oh, a chapel was on the list. And so this convent had all this all these facilities and a parking lot and a short hop to New York. It was just about 45 minutes into the city, so it was everything that they had asked for. And there was a turnover after the first year. Some people were leaving, and I found out about it and, reached out to be part of it. And there was, to bring my girlfriend Ginger with me, who was interested in doing this as well. So she had gotten involved in Course in Miracles right around the same time I did. So it was a factor in our relationship. And I would say overall an extremely positive one. There was some controversy because there are people at Miracle Manor, including a guy named Patrick, who later became one of my best friends there and who was a former top-level chef in New York City who gave me a culinary education. But initially, Patrick's opinion of me was I wasn't spiritual enough to be at Miracle Manor. He was pretty hard-headed, and eventually I convinced them, that they didn't really have the option to say that, and second, that I was just fine as far as being spiritual enough, and they made a decision to invite Ginger and me to Miracle Manor. And so I lived there for 1 year. We started the lessons over on September 1st, and continued them through the course of a year. And so what happened was that after I got my university education, I spent a year living in this community and studying A Course in Miracles, and then also experiencing what really became a residential experience in comparative spirituality, because at least the year that I was there, Ginger was there, there was, let's say, a partial dedication to A Course in Miracles. Not everybody was fully on board, and other people had spiritual paths that sort of dominated their work with the Course. A lot of people work with a guru down in the city at St. John the Divine named Hilda, and so forth. And so the community's focus on A Course in Miracles was not as strong in the second year, but me personally being studious and wanting to get the intended result, followed the instructions and did the lessons in order and thoroughly and carefully, and read the text a few times, because I would read the chapter and reread the chapter and sometimes read it a third time, and proceeded like that clear through the year. And while I was there, it was kind of the peak of the New Age movement, and there were all these people around who were, let's say, you know, had been involved with and studied, and sometimes for quite a long time, various different forms of spirituality, and many different teachings. And so in addition to doing A Course in Miracles, which doesn't really take that much time every day, it's, you know, you could get the whole thing down to, you know, half an hour a day. Most days, it's not much. If you're, especially if you keep your focus and do the reading a little bit at a time and do the one lesson a day, there were all these other ideas that I was being exposed to, and some of them were more formal and formal and structured concepts, and many were things like the woman who made contact with space aliens, and the woman who could hear plants talking to one another, and all kinds of things. I learned about all kinds of things. There are people who were pretty well-versed in the Edgar Cayce materials. There was a lot of talk about Earth changes, which in 1986 and 87, I don't think anybody was really talking about the ozone even. There was really not consciousness of the Earth as we knew it changing in any special way. Like, pretty much everyone thought, oh, this is just how it is and how it's going to be. And but there was talk of Earth changes at Miracle Matter. And a lot of the source of the material on Earth changes was coming out of the Edgar Cayce material. Let's see, the dental healers came through. I forget their names. They were kind of specialists in healing people's teeth. There was a channeler named Joan who would do these readings. Another channeler lived with us, and she did channeling for me. It's interesting, that notebook where I have the original typed copy is one of the few of my diaries I've ever kept that I don't have. I really hope it turns up someday, probably in a box or a file cabinet somewhere. And I learned a lot there. I learned a lot from the reading with Joan Brooks. I learned a lot from the reading, the little channeling that came through where I asked for advice from my writing angels, and the writing angels replied. Mine came through first, loud and clear, said, I think her name was Wanli, that was kind of her Miracle Manor name, said, "You're writing angels. Hi, we're your writing angels, and we want you to write humor. We want you to write comedy. We need you to make the world a funnier place because it's so serious and dismal, and, you know, that's what we want you to do. And don't worry, you're already known and surely loved." That's how it ended. Already known, in quotes, and surely loved. So all this is going on, and I'm in relationship with Ginger as well, and the ideas of the course, but more so the experiences of the course, were beginning to percolate directly into our lives. So we were having direct experiences together. And I was journaling the things that were happening. Very early on, a lot of unusual things started happening. And in addition to, you know, reading things that were compelling, as the course kind of proposes, the experiences become the thing that is the real teacher. And so there were some quite unusual ones. Perhaps I'll talk about them in later programs. I did journal those, and I do believe I still have that journal where there's a lot of kind of contemporaneous notes on these miraculous things that happened. So that's the kind of personal angle on things. There was one more thing that occurred, which was sort of a little bit of a confluence of a story, but let's see if I can weave this together. In the last couple of months in Buffalo, sometime in there, I was meditating and had a vision. And the vision was of me sitting on a window ledge with my feet kind of hanging out toward the outside of the window ledge. And it was a very large window, and I could see myself in the window, and also in the window were lots and lots of stars. I don't know what this was. I drew it in my notebook. I kind of sketched the image of me looking out at the stars. Then about maybe 2 or 3 months into being at Miracle Manor, I wanted to get a job as a writer. And this is a fun miracle story that I have told in writing before. But I was pretty depressed about the idea of like having to go out into the work world and be a writer. I had done very well working my way through the ranks of student publications on a large campus. I had written some great stories. I was pretty much a natural at journalism, but I couldn't see any way in. And somewhat mimicking the lament of my father when he was that age about how there were no jobs in TV, I thought, well, you know, there are no jobs for writers. And I said this between meals at the kitchen table at Miracle Manor, and the only Ginger was there, and one other person was there. I don't remember who it was. And there happened to be one page of the Newark Star-Ledger on the table. Now, the Newark Star-Ledger is a newspaper that was like 150 pages a day. It was a thick tabloid paper, kind of like the New York Post or the New York Daily News, the kind that doesn't fold in the middle, but that just has, that's like a big, loose comic book. And it was a big, thick thing, and half the thing was classified ads. And one of the pages, one page of the whole thing, like the thing that contained one sheet containing four pages, was left on the paper. Someone left it on the table. And it turned out to have on one side of it classified ads. And it happened to be the W page. And Ginger just picked it up and looked at it. And it was the W page, and she looked up writer. Writer wanted. Newspaper in Warren, New Jersey seeks, you know, starting reporter. Get the following phone number. I'm thinking, okay. That was weird, but whatever. And I hadn't said this to anyone. It wasn't like I'd been whining about wanting to be a writer. I just said it right then, and there happened to be a sheet of newsprint on the table, and Ginger picked it up, and there it was, writer wanted. And so I responded to the classified ad and got an interview. And before the interview, I had the foresight to do a little bit of reporting and to go to town hall of the town that I knew that I would be covering. It said right in the ad that the reporter was wanted to cover the township of Warren, New Jersey, in Somerset County. And so I found out when the town board or the planning board or whatever it was met. It must have been the planning board because I met Mrs. Wimmer. And so I went to the meeting, and the planning board was meeting, and there was a kid a little younger than me at the back of the room, and I was a reporter because I had a notebook in their lap taking notes, and I forget what the kid's name was, and he said, yeah, I'm filling in till I find the new person to cover Warren. And I said, oh, well, I've applied for that job. And he said, oh, well, that's good. So I had a co-conspirator to get the job. Then at the end of the meeting, I met Mrs. Wimmer, who was the planning board secretary, this lovely older lady who really liked me. And now I had a full-on conspiracy going to get this job. And one of the things I learned was that Flo Higgins, the editor of the paper who will be doing the hiring, was an astrologer and had a spiritual bookstore in Rumson, New Jersey. She had like a new age bookstore called Aquarius Rising Books, where she would do astrology readings. And she had a friend there named Antoinette who did tarot card readings. And they had all the great books of the new age. So I went to the meeting, but went to the interview. And I kind of had a little trick up my sleeve, which was that I would bring a bag, and in the middle of the meeting, out of the bag would fall a copy of a book called The Starseed Transmissions. Really one of the awesome, strange, channeled New Age works. Very, very well known at the time. The Starseed Transmissions, worth reading, by Raphael, later revealed to be Ken Carey. And she said, oh, The Starseed Transmissions. I know that book. Blah, blah, blah. And I said, Yeah, well, yeah, I love it. And, oh, you know, by the way, I'm doing the Course in Miracles and I live at Miracle Manor. Miracle Manor, what's that? It's a place where we're all doing the Course in Miracles and talking about all kinds of things, and pretty much was in. I didn't realize that I had met not only the person who would be my first editor at a professional newspaper, but also the person who would be the one who turned me on to astrology and being an astrologer. And so I got the job, and it was kind of freaky, but didn't seem so at the time. But now in retrospect, it's just hilarious that hanging above my desk was an astrology calendar, one of those like Jim Maynard calendars, like a monthly calendar with the aspects written in every day of the month. And again, I had no interest in astrology. I had no understanding in astrology, no intention to be an astrologer. But there's this thing above my desk, and I'm just kind of staring at it every day. And meanwhile, Flo doesn't ever stop talking about astrology. There was no astrology in the Echo Sentinel. It was this gritty Republican newspaper. But there was a lot of astrology in the office. And we'd hear about things like Saturn square the sun, and she would kind of crack the whip and say, that's about discipline. And then, you know, Mercury would be going retrograde. And the entire publishing group, we were part of a group of seven, now about 20, but that then at the time, seven different newspapers. And everyone in the entire company knew that Mercury was retrograde, because there was one central office where all of us people covering towns had to go once a week to do the final production on the paper. So Flo, having worked at the Echoes for Echoes Sentinel, was the name of the paper, for 27 years, had become kind of a permanent fixture, and would sort of terrorize the whole company with Mercury retrograde. And everyone knew that astrology existed. No one, you know, there were no other astrologers. There were, you know, no real other real astrology students, I guess, around. It was just Flo, one astrologer, kind of telling us everything. She was from the old school where it wasn't necessarily designed to be affirmative or positive, but nonetheless, she told us what was on her mind. And that turned out to be kind of the seed planted. And I got a copy of my chart, and I didn't really do anything with astrology for about 7 years. That's another story. But suffice it to say that at the beginning, at this turning point in my life, pretty much the course of my life for the next 30 years leading till now was being established. I had made a choice on some level to be an environmental investigative reporter as a result of Chernobyl. I had begun A Course in Miracles. I had moved into this community where I was being exposed to all these things on a daily basis and having conversations about interdimensional beings and space aliens. And not, mind you, I didn't really have a head for any of this stuff. I was not all that interested. My spiritual path up to that point had been reading fairly serious works, like the works of Alan Watts and Hugh Prather and transpersonal psychology and so forth. And then here I was suddenly like listening to people conversing with plants and channeling space brothers and spending time up on the ship. Now, none of this is in A Course in Miracles, but at Miracle Manor, it was this kind of hodgepodge collection of people who had all these various different spiritual interests, all of whom, except for Ginger — I was the second youngest person there, Ginger was the youngest — all of whom, except for Ginger, were older than I was, some of them by 10 or 15 or 20 years. Some were pretty far advanced in the work they were doing. One was working on a PhD and so forth. And so I had exposure to all that, and I got my first job as a newspaper reporter and met an astrologer. So it was really a pretty miraculous time where, though I had no idea how things might work out or should work out, I would say that my encounter with A Course in Miracles was marked by a whole confluence of events that led credibility to what I was doing, that said, you're doing the right thing, this is the right path to be on. And usually, at least when I get that confirmation, I just stay on the right path. If I'm on the right path, and it's leading to interesting developments, I stay on it. And that is what I did. So all that kind of leads to right now. My skepticism with this work comes from a few different angles. One is that I was keenly aware that the course did not talk about sex at all. It had a pretty interesting position on relationships, though, which is going to be the topic of many of these conversations that I at least have with you and elicit response in some way. Perhaps we'll do some live programs as well. And I was also skeptical of religion. But this is mind level stuff, right? So I'm reading and doing the work and doing the practice, and things are actually happening. But later on, I question some of that because clearly it's seemingly religious in nature. A Course in Miracles is purported to be a channeled work through a scribe named Helen Schuckman, who was basically a professor of medical psychology or a research fellow of medical psychology. I'm not sure her exact job title, at Columbia University School of Physicians and Surgeons. And her boss, William Thetford, the other part of the channeling team, was also a clinical, like a medical psychologist, basically. They weren't MDs. They were psychologists. And this kind of thing of channeling was highly controversial. They kept it secret. She kept her name off of it for a long time, and it was published anonymously. Later, when she died, her name went onto the work. I believe she died in 1981 or so, and her name was then put onto the work. And so the idea that something is channeled is potentially controversial. But when you're reading this thing, there is something, call it a feeling tone, that's unusual about it. And it seemed like something a little off the normal spectrum of what I had read in writing before. And the voice that was in the writing seemed familiar, and I just stuck with it despite my, belief level concerns or objections that arose from time to time. And I'm sure this is the case of many people who've done this. After all, you're reading about things that are unusual and not on the normal menu. And yet it gets some credibility because it's not making any specific demands. It's just ideas. You don't have to go any place or do much except pause a number of times during the day and stop and reflect. There's no writing to do. Once you bought the books, there's no money to send. You just buy these books and you do this thing. And so I would say that for all of the issues I might have about this being essentially seeming to be a religious work that is channeled in the first person from Jesus of Nazareth, right? Here's where we get into perhaps the first qualified philosophical question here, right? Which I would say is, if this were not purported to be a channeling from the spirit of Jesus of Nazareth coming through a Jewish atheist psychologist named Helen Schuckman, would anyone take it as seriously as they do? Would it have the cachet that it does? If it were simply A Course in Miracles by Helen Schuckman with help from Bill Thetford, would it have gone anywhere? Now, of course, it cannot be proven through any editorial means that it was a channeling of Jesus of Nazareth. So, though to my understanding, the manuscripts, the handwritten notebooks, and then the original typescripts exist, and the original typescript is published. And there were a number of revisions made. We did not know that at the time. It was not, the history of Course in Miracles was not well published. But that is the first question that I would leave you with, is if it was just by Helen Schuchman, would it matter as much? Would we care as much? And does it matter that there's not proof? So we get into these kind of intellectual level questions that I think are probably on a different level than the direct teaching, where the instructions say, go inside of your mind and make contact with the light that's there. And then you do that and you suddenly figure out that there's light inside of you. And there's repeated kind of instructions from a different viewpoint every day of how to do that in a different way, how to practice forgiveness, what the meaning of forgiveness is, what the why and the ultimately the power of forgiveness, and how it's possible, indeed even easy, to practice that, and what it means to be living in the world as a teacher. And probably the most difficult thing for most people is the fact that the Course is written in Christian language. It uses the reference points of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so if you want to experiment with this and do this, you have to deal with the Father, Son, Holy Spirit stuff, and you also have to deal with all the male pronouns, right? So this is not written in politically correct or progressive language, but it's there, it exists, and that's the story of basically how it came into my life and some description of what this thing is. And so in the weeks that follow, I'm planning to talk about a number of issues, including, of course, this position on sexuality, which was edited out, but I have access to the unrevised manuscript and have done some research there, and the Course's position on relationships, and looking at some of the specific lessons and the ideas in some of the lessons and the ideas that are contained in the text. So that's my intention for what to do here, and then to put it out in the world, and basically, like I do with everything else I do, see what happens next. So thanks for listening. I do intend to be back in 1 week with another edition of the Miracle Hour for Pacifica Radio. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino.